Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there, Huey.
Riley.
I couldn't help but notice your sign, and I hope you boys aren't too upset about me having to prosecute Mr. Kelly.
Hey, man, you do what you gotta do.
Why R. Kelly, huh? What did R. Kelly do to you?
He's accused of relieving himself on an underage girl on tape, which is against the law.
Okay. But let's examine this whole peeing thing, so I can pee in the toilet, and it's okay. But if I pee on a person, it's, like, not okay.
Well, yeah.
Well, what if I'm peeing and Huey's in the bathroom and I accidentally pee on Huey? Should I go to jail?
What the hell would I be doing in the bathroom while you're in the bathroom?
Hold up. Remember when we used to sleep in the same bed when we was littler? From time to time, I'd have a little accident.
You still do?
Shut up! So, Mr. Dubois, Mr. I wanna lock niggas up for peeing. What's the statute of limitations on bedwetting? Why not prosecute me and R. Kelly at the same time, huh?
Now, Riley, no one's going to prosecute you for bedwetting.
And you shouldn't. It's a natural bodily function, and now every nigga in the world gonna be scared to pee. I may never pee again.
Riley, it was a little girl.
Oh, I seen that girl. She ain't little. I'm little.
Yes.
Gary Coleman's little.
Yes.
Mini-Me is little.
Very.
And to the best of my knowledge, we all managed to avoid getting peed on so far.
But what about the victim?
Oh, yes, the victim. At what point does personal responsibility become a factor in this equation?
I don't think that...
I see piss coming, I move.
Mm.
She saw piss coming, she stayed.
Yes, she did,
and why should I have to miss out on the next R. Kelly album just for that? Man. You just got beat by an 8-year-old.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane.
No, it's Max, Darryl, and D-Bert, your host for the Comic Shop Show.
You still do. Shut up. Folks, that was a clip from the upcoming fourth season, highly anticipated fourth season of The Boondocks, courtesy of Adult Swim. Folks, this is The Grindhouse, more specifically, the Comic Shop segment of The Grindhouse. And then, of course, at 7 p.m., we have Afro Nerd featuring Captain Kirk. Listen, we're expecting a guest and a friend, Mr. Brandon Easton. He should be with us shortly. Noted filmmaker, author, screenwriter, graphic novelist. We've spoken about him on a number of occasions, and he is a force to be reckoned with, so we expect him once again shortly. And, of course, we have our own podcast enterprise crew with myself, the uncanny Daryl B., and, of course, Captain Kirk. Folks, let's go to a quick, and I do mean quick, groove. And when we get back, discourse, and, of course, Mr. Easton, and just a whole bunch of comic book pulp fare. The call-in number, once again, as always, before I go to the groove, 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. Let's go to a quick, as I said, nerdcore groove. This is Sinestro Core featuring Tribe One. Let's get to it. We'll be right back.
Silver Age.
Hey, start a revolution.
Yeah.
Start a riot like Quentin Quire. Otto Octavius after Peter Parker expire. Bizarro dark side, god of mischief and horns on my head. Kneel before Zada, you're dead. Yo, parallax with the battle rap. Ain't no bad a cat with a shattered past. Like Luther sipping on Sazerac. As a matter of fact, me and Tri One, we're like Scott Steiner. We turn on our brothers and blew the hell up. Check my suit, all yellow. Scarecrow looking fella. To put the fear in you, your cat is like waiting for Polaroid pics to develop. Shaking, not stirred. Oh, you're not scared. Don't you know that you're sleeping? The nightmares are absurd. This is the age of Ultron. The pages I wrote on became the stages I spoke on. When all the rage was in making that pop cultural rap about comics, maybe Adam did it way better than that. So what have y'all done for me lately? This is the Mutant Liberation Front. The Marauders, the Brotherhood, the Morlocks. Stealing your sons and your daughters. We are the ones you used to shove in the lockers. The ones you pushed and so we pushed back harder. Iraqi Sergeant Slaughter. This one goes out to those cats on OWA. I didn't know him, so I dropped out of the core when I'm older. Antimatter, now I'm rocking a ring of my own. Targaryen fucking crazy when I'm taking the throne.
This ain't nerdcore.
This is the Necrocore.
Yo, what's your skirt for?
This is the Necrocore.
The Silver Age MCs and still fear in the game.
Oh, we're the Krypton, still repping the same.
This ain't nerdcore.
This is the Necrocore.
Yo, what's your skirt for?
This is the Necrocore.
The Silver Age MCs and still fear in the game.
Oh, we're the Krypton, still reppin' the same.
Still the illest in the Milky Way. Still familiar with a million brilliant ways to fill a page with the skill we illustrate and chill until we kill the stage. Supervillain renegade, release the genophage. I'm seen beneath the metal face of doom, breathing medicated.
Okay, folks, just a skosh, just a skosh, a game that was Sinestro Core featuring Tribe One. And of course, as I stated before at the top of the show, I could not do the show without any kind of efficacy, without any kind of accuracy, without our own Enterprise crew. First up is the captain. Captain, you need it in engineering. Let's get to it.
Divergent tickets went on sale March 4th. It is now the 22nd. Things are going to be different this year, people. Let's go.
And of course, we have the uncanny Daryl B.
We won't have time to get into it on this show, but I'm wishing all the luck to my Asian brothers and sisters. At least with this argument you're going to bring up involving Iron Fist, at least Marvel will pay attention that Asians need to be represented in these movies too.
Well, you know, listen, I believe Mr. Easton is waiting in abeyance, and we're going to talk about that, and of course his work. But you know, everyone needs to be represented, Daryl. I concur. Everyone has to be represented, and I think the excuses are wearing thin on some level. PlayStation has given an option for the Powers TV show. You heard about that, right, Daryl?
Yep.
I mean, you know, FX was allegedly in line for this thing, and now we're hearing that PlayStation's getting it. I said, wait a minute, there's so many outlets now. Come on. The excuses are wearing thin. As I stated at the show, we have a guest coming through. A rather prolific guest, Mr. Brandon Easton. He actually started with us many years ago when we first started this show. I think, Daryl, you might remember him calling in a few times when we first started doing the comic shop specifically. And we recently spoke with him at the second annual Schaumburg Black Comic Con, which was a great thing to see. You know, I just can't wait till next year, to be honest with you. I have a lot of excitement for it. Anyway, as I was saying, you know what? I think this is the gentleman. I think he's outside the studios now. Brandon.
Yes, I'm here.
Hello. Welcome once again, after all this time, to the Comic Shop. Glad you started to come by.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Listen, we brought you on actually to ask more about what you're doing, and we thoroughly enjoy Watson and Holmes, and you are really a busy person. You have a lot of things in a lot of things to really consider, a lot of works out there. And you recently were interviewed for Comic Book Resources, their diversity issue. I think it's called Color Barrier,
that
segment on that website. So you said some things that we talk about all the time, you know, incessantly. So I thought it would be apropos to have you on the show to talk about that and, of course, to talk about your projects. For our audience, give us a little bit about your background in this pulp fiction, pulp fantasy world. How did you get started, and some of your more recent projects?
Okay, but as a disclaimer real quick, I have a very bad reception. I get very bad reception on my phone in my house, so if I get disconnected, I'll call right back.
Okay, no problem.
Cool. All right, now first things first. Well, I broke into comics originally back in 2002 at a Dreamwave Productions on a book called Arcanium, which was done by a brother, done with me and a brother named LaShawn Thomas, who went on to work on the Boondocks and went overseas to work in a South Korean animation studio. From there, it was a long, long drought between the work I did at Dreamwave and the time I actually put out my own work. In fact, I think in terms of comic books, I didn't have anything produced between 2003 and 2012 when my book Shadow Law was released. And really the way I broke in was I went to San Diego Comic-Con back in 1999 and again in 2003, and I met a lot of people down in San Diego, and I also was living in Boston at the time, and I knew some people up there who were trying to break in. So it was about, I'd say about a good solid three years of hustling really hard and working really hard and getting my name out there, and a lot of trial, a lot of error. Things didn't always go my way. In fact, 98.9% of the time, things did not go my way, but that's the way it is in this industry. Things don't go your way. You just have to learn how to bounce back from that. In terms of TV stuff, I was teaching in New York City for about 6 years, and in the middle of 2008, I figured that I needed to give my Hollywood dreams a shot before I got any older, because back in, you know, years before, I'd earned a master's degree in screenwriting, and I figured, you know, why should that go to waste? So I packed up my life and just moved from, at the time I was living in New York, in the Bronx, and I moved from the Bronx to L.A. in the midst of the worst economic climate in recent history, and it was a really horrible time. I mean, I struggled and scraped and worked three jobs and begged, borrowed and stole, and basically eventually, because of some old connections I had and the fact that some people were willing to take a chance on me, I got a chance to write on the 2011 Thundercats reboot that Warner Brothers did. And then after that, I got a shot at writing an episode of Transformers Rescue Bots for Hasbro, which is actually going to be on the Hub Network tomorrow. I think my episode already aired, but it's called Tip of the Iceberg, so that should be on tomorrow if you have access to the Hub Network. And that's pretty much how I broke in a nutshell.
Terrific. Well, I tell you this much, you definitely show a great deal of perseverance, and I mean, that's really what it's all about. Listening to your story, you could have easily given up, but it seems that when someone starts to become, to make some headway in this business or in anything, it requires that stick-to-itiveness and that ability to kind of just stick it out. So I'm glad to hear that. Because I remember you called in our show when we first started. And the funny thing is that I suspect you called in because it really isn't a show, and even to this day, really, which that's another thing that has to be explored. And we're doing what we're trying to do on the back end ourselves. But there really isn't a show that explores black pop culture for some reason, or rather, the shows that you do hear about, they're very truncated. They're shows that deal with, you know, Real Housewives of Atlanta, Hip House Housewives, and then that's the end of it.
Right.
Much. When we spoke at the Schomburg, there's so much content that if you actually tallied the content, the amount of content as far as black pop culture representation, it would be quite immense. But no one is doing that. Everything's kind of stuck on this kind of ghettoized thing.
Right.
Talk more about that. I was very, very intrigued with what you said in the diversity piece. And again, folks, we're speaking to Mr. Brandon Easton. You can go to Comic Book Resources with that particular piece, the color barrier. And it's all about diversity in comics. But you talked about this thing of, if I'm paraphrasing, you said something about that black folks are going to have to kind of create their own infrastructure, that we kind of begging and begging. Kind of elaborate more on that.
Okay, well, the color barrier articles was created, or the color barrier column was created by a brother named Joe Illich, who used to be an editor at Milestone Media back in the day, and he also was an editor on the Batman books at DC Comics back in the day as well. He's doing some incredible stuff now. Well, basically, I want to backtrack a little bit. Here's the deal with what's going on. There are a lot of black folks who are working in what we call Hollywood or the entertainment industry as writers and producers. The problem is, when it comes to writers and producers, you never see these people's faces on television, because you can see your name, and most, you know, obviously not everybody's name is, you know, quote-unquote black, you know, whatever that means, but, you know, there's brothers like Kevin Grievous, who co-created the Underworld franchise and Edith R. Frankenstein, which is still going to continue, I believe, as a comic. There's a brother out there by the name of Jeffrey Thorne, who was a writer on the TV series Leverage, and he also wrote a Star Trek novel called Star Trek Titan. There's a brother named Hannibal Taboo, who's doing stuff. There's also another brother named Dwayne Copeland, who actually got profiled in Jet Magazine for a black superhero web series that's on YouTube right now. It's been on there for a while now, called CV Nation. And
we've covered
about
that.
Another, mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's probably another 20 people whose names that are in my head that I could probably rattle off, but the reality is there's a lot of us working in the industry. Now, the flip side is there's not enough of us at the level to green light a series to put it on television. So what has to happen, and it's going to happen slowly but surely, but as more and more of us start creating more, you know, genre material like sci-fi and fantasy, that people in L.A. within the infrastructure of the industry like, then you'll start to see it roll out. The perfect example of this business ethic or this business model would be what Issa Rae did with her series, The Misadventures of an Awkward Black Girl, where she found a need. She was looking for a certain audience. She found that audience online, and she got a lot of attention for it. And then, you know, the sister who created Grey's Anatomy, Shonda Rhimes, saw Issa Rae's work, and then she, you know, hooked her up. And now Issa Rae had a deal at ABC, and now she has a deal at HBO. And her stuff is extremely non-stereotypical. It's a little bit wacky, a little bit different. But, you know, that's an example of what has to happen. So what we're going to have to continue to do as creators is constantly make material and hope to God that at least one of those things somebody likes. Because the problem is that there's a lot of us creating, but the audience hasn't really gravitated to us, even when they know we exist. And one of the things I'm doing to remedy that is I've produced, written, and directed a documentary that'll be coming out on May 8th called Brave New Souls, Black Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of the 21st Century. And I really want folks to realize that we do exist, but we also need the support, because we won't get a Walking Dead-style show on the air until people buy the stuff that we create, because Walking Dead didn't end up on TV overnight. It ended up on TV after years and years and years of the comic book selling, in fact, outselling Marvel and DC stuff. So we have stuff that's out now. There's a bunch of black novelists who are creating fantasy epics and science fiction epics. There's a sister named N.K. Jemisin. There's another sister named Nnedi Okorafor. There's, there's so many people I'm just, like, blanking out on. But there's folks out there doing this stuff already. So what we've got to do is, one, let the black community or anybody really who's interested in our material know that we exist, and then folks have to step up and actually buy it, because what happens a lot of the times, and I used to live in New York. I still, when I go to New York, go to Midtown Comics every time I'm there. And one of the things I'll notice is Midtown Comics has a huge black and Latino clientele, right?
Yeah, I noticed that too.
They don't, Right. They don't pick up the black or Latino books. There'll be a new independently produced, beautiful looking black comic book on the shelf, and it'll be next to Superior Spider-Man. They'll pick up the black book, flip through it, put that down, and then grab Superior Spider-Man or the new X-Men or Uncanny Avengers or whatever the hell else is going on right now in Marvel and DC. So they'll do that, and meanwhile, our books will still sit there and collect dust, and then those same guys will go home and get online and be like, hey, why are there no black people doing this? Why don't black people get hired at Marvel and DC? I'm like, the only way we'll get hired at Marvel and DC is if we make noise on the independent level in terms of sales. It's not just creating it. People have to buy it. And that's the dilemma. It's this like chicken and egg thing that we can't get out of as black creators and black consumers. So I will wrap it up to say on this side, in this particular topic, there are a lot of us out there creating. I just don't think people know we exist.
Well, sorry to jump in, but this is Darryl B. That's why I'm kind of glad what Lion Forge is doing, which you're affiliated with. Lion Forge and stuff like that, because I'm getting to see more of this, more ethnic representation in the book form. It's just not happening from the big two. And
exactly.
when I have friends asking me about, oh, hey, you collect all of this, what about the, and I go, hey, check out Watson Holmes, check out Lion Forge. Check out this. Check out that. I point out that these are books that are going like underneath the surface. That's why I love reading Hannibal Tattoo's The Buy Pile, because and one of his books, the Crown Ascension, I recommend wholeheartedly. We need to read. There needs to be a spotlight. That's why I said with the inroads we have in media, all right, with BT, with TV1, with, I know you're groaning because you already know the second part of this. It just hasn't done enough for diversity in the genre. Not diversity on the screen, but diversity in the genre, because there's only so many of the same shows we could do, sir,
You know what? I actually talked to somebody at BT and TV1, and I can tell you why we don't get science fiction on there, if you really want to know.
Oh, this is going to be juicy. Captain, take notes.
Okay, here it goes. Now, you don't have to take what I'm saying as gospel. It's up to you. But from what I understand, BET, TV1, and whatever else is out there is marketed toward upper-middle-class black women. According to every bit of demographic research that these two or these other organizations use as their metrics, as a way of developing programming, they're under the impression that upper-middle-class black women do not like science fiction or fantasy, despite the fact that when you go to watch these Avengers movies and Dark Knight, there's a lot of black upper-middle-class black women in the audience. However, they're under the impression that for television, and, TV is based on advertisers. That's it. There's an old joke in the industry that, commercials don't interrupt TV shows. TV shows interrupt commercials, That's TV exists for commercials. That's it. So there are companies out there that want to get to upper middle class black women viewers. So therefore, all those horrible, 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 horrible shows that we see with like Baby's Mamas and Housewives and Preachers and the hookers and on the all this horrible stuff. I mean, they are under the impression that this is what black women want to watch. Therefore, they program with that in mind. So a show like, let's say if they did a black version of Heroes, right? I think that would do extremely well. But the people in power do not, because they have enough demographic data from and for their advertisers to suggest that that program wouldn't do well on those networks. And it doesn't matter who creates it. I mean, even if Will Smith created something and went to him, I even doubt that even Will Smith could get something on one of those networks, because they're under the impression that this is exactly what our viewership wants to see. And I don't know how to change that. So, and if there are people here in the industry who have pilot scripts that went to BET, that went to TV One, that were rejected offhand only because of the genre it was in. So that's what's going on, bro.
All right, thanks for the honest answer.
Unfortunately.
Captain, I'm sure you have something to say about this. Captain Kirk, of course, you're speaking to Mr. Brandon Easton. Your thoughts?
Hey.
Okay, how's it going, sir? Just to piggyback
on what you're
doing well, sir. Just to piggyback on what you said, I had known someone that compiled information for Netflix, and they said, and they had showed me a chart one time, and they said to me, look, this is what black people are watching. And then you see the type of shows according to their list now. You know, it was just the same shows there that BET were talking about. That's the list that they were going by. So let's say a black neighborhood, a black, quote-unquote, area, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would say, look, here it is. This is our Liberty City. Look at what people here in Liberty City are watching. All right?
Mm.
But then I would say to the person, I said, okay, show me the higher income. Liberty City, your chances are that's going to be lower income. Show me higher income areas.
Right.
And they would show me that list. Now, of course, you would get some of the other more diverse things, but even on that list, too, you know, you would see some of the same things that you would see right there in a city like Liberty City or something like that. And this is the list
right.
that they're going from, you know. So here's the thing. You know, this is the statement that I want to make. You know, it's one thing to promote guys such as yourself and let everybody know that you're out there. You need to be on a huge platform. But also the mindset of the consumer has to change somewhat, too, you know,
true.
Based on the statistics that I've seen.
Right.
You know, that's all I wanted to say.
No, but I mean, I can't argue with that. I mean, if folks are watching what they're watching or if they're choosing, well, see, and this is the only thing empirically you have to think about is how they're getting their data and what are they leaving out. Those are the questions I would ask. I will say this much, you know, in that regard. I've been, because of Lion Forge, and Lion Forge has been flying me around to a bunch of conventions last year, and I got a chance to visit many corners of this country. A lot of the places I went, there were so many black, and let's just stick to black folk, there were so many black people at every convention I went. I went to conventions in St. Louis, I went to conventions in Chicago, New York City. I even went down to Barbados, you know, and they got a convention there called AnimeCon down in Barbados. And, you know, Barbados obviously is a black country, and that place was packed. And I just don't know what's happening because I'm wondering if there's a way to determine who's actually watching the science fiction stuff because I know brothers and sisters, because I'm from Baltimore originally, and Baltimore is very interesting because you have extremely poor blacks, and then you have extremely wealthy blacks all in the same area, right?
Yes, sir.
I'm wondering if they're missing out on the black genre metric because, black viewership genre metric because I know way too many folks who are into this stuff, and then I talk to too many black folks online, and I meet a lot of black folks in the industry, and it just seems to be there's some kind of like logistical barrier where somebody someplace is sitting up on high saying, no, black people don't want to watch that. But then when Heroes was on, you know, a lot of black folks was watching that. And then when, you know, Avengers came out, and I saw Avengers, you know, at a couple of different places, and the audiences were extremely diverse. So I don't know how to properly evaluate or properly measure, you know, what black folks are actually watching versus what the metrics say that they are. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not discounting what you're saying because it's true, because when they do the math, it always comes up with, you know, Basketball Wives and, you know, stuff in the Kardashians and stuff like that. So I'm just wondering how we can get that message out. I don't know what to do. I mean, I can't answer that, you know, unfortunately.
I tell you something. I have some ideas, and I think some of it is it deals with the old joke of what came first, the chicken or the egg, in the sense of looking at these shows because that's all they're given, or is it something else? Because if you gave them something else, would they look at that? Because this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you continue to produce this kind of thing, well, the black, look at this, black people only look at this. Well, that's all you give them. I mean, Daryl, you remember this gentleman. We spoke about him a few times. I think it might have been Comic Book Resources or another black fanzine – not black fanzine, but another fanzine website where he said – I think he's a artist where he talked about going to Louisiana or something, and he was teaching kids about
Not Jamal Engle. You know, I think it's Jamal Engle. His comments about how the students were shocked that they could find out they could be artists and writers.
Yes, yes.
And they said, well, black folks are into this. We didn't know black people could do that. That was their response.
Yes.
They just didn't know. I mean, I'm a big proponent. You know, we're a big proponent on this show, not only of comic books, but of urban alternative culture and discourse, period. And I do it not just because I'm interested in it, but because I see it's another revenue potential, another revenue stream that's not being explored that might actually help black folks move forward. To me, I'm going to say for the sake of this conversation, use the term black sci-fi. Black sci-fi, black fantasy, black video game representation, all that kind of stuff, It's not something that should be taken lightly. It is something that is necessary. I mean, truly necessary for our survival. And what I mean by that, well, somebody's saying, what is a video game? What does comic books? What does that mean for survival? It gives people, especially people of color, critical thinking ability. We wouldn't have the technology we have today if it were not for the geeks in the mid-60s and late-60s looking at Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
What does that say? If what are we going to accomplish if all we see is T.I. and Tiny all day? I mean, I'm looking at it from that perspective. I look at this as a necessity to engender black folks to think mathematically, to think logically. I mean, there's so many things we can be doing just by fantasy and sci-fi is an important thing for people, but I'm saying black and brown folks specifically, so they can think beyond, so we can invent, can imagine. Looking at these, and I call them what I call them, minstrels, neo minstrels. We're stuck, and I think part of it also is we've got to create, even if it's online, and I hope AfroNerd represents that to a certain degree, a hub or an infrastructure, so we can put all this stuff together and say, hey, look, guess what? Look at me now. This is what we're doing here. We're not joining collectively, Brandon, I think. It's more about, like you said, you have your colleagues, but all of you are kind of floundering, doing separate things. What would happen if all of you came under one house? Issa Rae, Anthony Montgomery, I saw he was in your documentary. I mean, let's put all these people together and make it one pulsating black sci-fi fantasy product. Then they can't say, well, you black folks aren't into it. Like I'm like you. I've gone to to all these comic shows, these comic book stores, and I'm sitting around saying there's a lot of black guys, a lot of black men and women buying comic books. With, you know, something's going on. So I think.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna answer that quick. Okay, now first you were saying why aren't folks out here all getting together now? That's really tricky, and I'm going to be honest about it. But, you know, creative people are extremely egotistical, okay? I know some really brilliant people, you know, and I mean, I'm not going to say I don't have an ego, but I check it when it comes to working with other people. The problem is this, and I'm going to say this, and I know a lot of people aren't going to like this, but there's a lot of black folk who work in the business who have this mentality, and excuse me for what I'm about to say, but it's like, nigga, I did it, you got to do it too. They're under the impression that if you try to network with them, you're trying to get something from them that is not earned. So the problem is folks aren't actually floundering necessarily because they get paid well to do these scripts that people buy but they never do anything with, you know. But it's very difficult to get someone who is under the impression blacks aren't working as hard as they are. There are folks I know in the industry, and, you know, I'm not really friends with some of these people, but they really do believe on some level that other black people would be further along if they just did what I did. Never mind that that same person did have a mentor or someone that opened the door or, you know, gave them a good word at some point or other. So the problem is there's a lot of egotistical but brilliant people out there who generally only want to do their own thing. And it's really tough to walk up to a person who has that mentality and be like, hey, I'd like to learn from you, without them looking at it like, oh, this guy has his hand out. You know what I mean? So that's one of the reasons why you're not seeing this massive conglomeration of all these black folks come together and work together. Because one thing I learned when I came out here, because the black community within itself is ridiculously diverse, you know? And there's black folks I've met in the industry who I do not like at all, because they're from a different place in the country, and the way they were raised is very different than how I view what black is. So just like, you know, you don't get all white people working together, or all Asians or all Latinos, you're not going to get all black people working together either. Now, you do find your circle. Like, I found my circle of people, but out of that circle, once again, other folks, they got bills to pay. They got families, they got kids, they got wives, they got all this stuff going on, right? So it's very hard to get them to be willing to take a hit financially so that we can work together, because that's what it would take. It would take that person who has that kind of connection and that kind of juice to make a massive sacrifice financially and also put their name on the line in order to get us from point A to point B. And not everybody's willing to do that, you know, and that's the tough part. And what the difference is with white folks, or let's say Jewish Americans in the industry or other groups, you know, you have so many folks that you have more people physically willing to take those chances, whereas our numbers, while not small, are nowhere near as big as the other groups I've mentioned. You know, so that's what the problem is, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, we can't get enough of us together with the amount of capital to survive a hit or survive putting their necks on the line. And then when you have egos clashing, I get where you're coming from with that. There's too many factors before we as a people have our own Marvel Assembling the Universe milestone, assembling a movie universe. It's going to be a couple decades before we get that, where we're talking about the static and icon movie on screen, and how we had to fight to get Blood Syndicate and have these movie houses take chances on that, you know? I get the point. But still, hey, it's Afro Nerd. I'm a nerd. I'm dreaming about this, you know, because I see what Marvel's doing. I see what DC is squandering. I see what the female lit authors are doing with their stuff on screen now. I'm seeing all of that, and I'm thinking about the strong characters, unknown characters we got, and the yet untapped potential. And then I'm seeing news stories about people fighting about the Kim and Kanye's cover and stuff I'm not saying we're the only ones. It's just there's so few of us that have the position to be up there, but when we're up there, we look like fools. That's the problem. That's what drives us nuts, you know. You know, and like I said, there's few of us that have tried and attempted. That's why I give props to Kev Graveau. He constantly is out there. I give props to Will Smith. He's constantly out there. You know, hey, After Earth. You know, critical flop, but you know what? He put his talents behind that. He tried to expand our minds with that, and I had to hear, oh, this is phony black. Whoa. All I know is I can only tell you what my mom is, all right? My mom is black, a nurse, all right? But she's hooked with Once Upon a Time. She's hooked on Resurrection.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
She's hooked on the new Elementary, and she keeps on asking me questions. And I'm like, hey, yeah, this is some of the stuff I read and stuff like that. And I'm like, and she goes, what's your theories, Daryl, on this? And I'm like, I don't want to give you my theories, because then it'll turn into a 10, 15-minute thought session about the possible path they could go down. You know?
But, you know,
Well, I'm sorry, no, Daryl.
No, but that's what I'm saying. If we could get more people higher up in our community to give these properties a chance and to think like that, to just give it a chance to take a look at the product, you know, we'd be better off. But the problem is there's that stigma. You know, that ain't for us.
What I wanted to say, and I think is important, is, listen, there's a mentality that's out there that we have to deal with, too. Not that I disagree with what Brandon was talking about, but then I can think of stories that are so harrowing as to what black folks do with their money that is frightening. Mm. I hate to use Media Takeout as a source because they're part of the problem. They're part of the problem as well. But, you know, the minstrel, when it comes to business, the minstrel business, people seem to be able to do everything the opposite than what Brandon just spoke about. What, you know, rappers are able to collaborate in ignorance and degradation. Anytime there's a product that deals with degrading black folks, that people can jump on that and people can make money from that. I mean, I'm looking at this seriously. But a Media Takeout, there's a story of some new football player, some rookie, that allegedly signed a $15 million contract and just spent $1 million in a strip club.
Yeah, I heard that this morning.
I'm like, okay, wait a minute. A person that can throw away $1 million, do you know what $1 million could do for a project, whether it's sci-fi, whatever, just business, just a community? $1 million is a hell of a lot of money that can change lives, and this fool, quote unquote, tricked it off in a moment at a strip club. So when you factor in a story like that, and you factor in the minstrel business, where black folks appear to be able to get together and conduct business without any kind of prompting or provocation, and they're able to do it successfully. You know, but it's degrading, though. Now, this, what we're proposing is the antithesis of the minstrel business, and yet we scratch our heads and we don't know what to do. That's my problem.
No, you know what? I mean, I'm in 100% agreement with you. There's something I talked about back when 12 Years a Slave came out, and it was with my friends in a couple of spots on Facebook. You know, I think that black Americans specifically are preconditioned to complain about everything. You know what I mean? I'll give you an example. Now, I'm a child of the 80s. I was born in the 70s. In the early 90s, you went through that hood movie boom when you had, like, Juice and Men's Society, Boys in the Hood, all that stuff, right? That Presidents, the whole nine. And back then, black folks was like, oh, man, why everything got to be in the hood? I bet you they won't make no movies about slavery. And then they make movies about slavery, and people are complaining, oh, man, why are they making movies about slavery? Why don't they make movies about something else? It just feels like we're never satisfied, you know what I mean? And we don't ever go for the solutions. I don't know if that's a result of, you know, all the negative social conditioning that we have, but there's a brass ring that people – it's not even a glass ceiling anymore. It's like a ring that's just dangling there, and we're not reaching for it collectively, you know? And that's what I don't understand. So for whatever reason – instead of reaching for the brass ring, we keep looking at the ground and celebrating nonsense. And it's across the board. You know, we celebrate, you know, we have people celebrating people getting out of jail, but people don't celebrate when somebody gets out of college. You know, not because people do, but I'm saying, you know, Chris Rock said it best, that, you know, people have getting out of jail parties and celebration that someone broke the law, did time, and then got out. I mean, that's not really a cause for celebration. The celebration is that they got out and got a good job and were able to give back to their community. You know what I mean? So, yeah, we have this, like, thing where we don't ever go for the solution. And I don't know, once again, how to fix that because we're here. Like, me and a bunch of other folks have the material you're talking about. Now, the way to get it in the Hollywood space is for the sales to be high. And in order for the sales to be high, people have to, one, know we exist, and two, buy it when they know we exist. And that's the only thing that's going to change that thing. Now, we do have an issue with depreciating assets. I talk about this all the time. You know, we should not be spending money on Jordans. You know, you see folks camping out overnight to buy a pair of sneakers, but they don't camp out overnight to vote. You know, And I'm like, hey, I don't care. I mean, everybody has their thing. You know, I play video games. That's a depreciating asset. The day you buy it, the console is not worth what you buy, particularly if you try to take it back to GameStop, you know. So I get it, you know. But there comes a point where you have to invest your money in your community and in yourself. And all the creators I know, some of us are doing really well financially. Some of us are still struggling. You know, I'm still check to check, you know. But, you know, we put our money where our mouth is. You know, we put the money and invest it. Like, a graphic novel costs a lot to produce because you have to pay an artist. You know, I had to pay, you know, for Shadow Law to get produced. I'm paying for something else to get produced. All the cats I know, they pay for their stuff to get produced, you know. So we've already put our resources toward an investment, a cultural investment, a positive cultural investment. And once again, we don't always have that level of support that we need. So, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with long-term conditioning. I mean, black people, more than any other group per capita, watch more TV than any other group per capita. We watch more movies than any other group. We are some of the biggest consumers of entertainment. However, I can tell you this. I used to get into nasty arguments with a lot of black geeks because they will still buy Lord of the Rings, but they won't buy, you know, the 100,000 Kingdoms, which is written by a person, like I mentioned her before, her name is N.K. Jemisin. She won, like, a World Fantasy Award for her book, The 100,000 Kingdoms. And yet, black folks, when they found out she's black, they still don't go and buy her book. They still will say, well, why aren't there any black people in Game of Thrones? I'm like, you don't need to put black people in Game of Thrones because there are black people writing those types of stories right now. There's a brother named Lamar Giles who did a young adult novel with a black male lead, which is extremely rare. His book is called Fake ID, okay? Got all kind of good reviews. I don't know how well it's selling, but the point is that he needs to get the attention because he signed to a major publisher. I think he signed with Scholastic, which is one of the biggest publishers in the world, you know? And he's not, I don't feel he's getting the attention he deserves. So it goes back to the fact that there are solutions here, right? But folks aren't reaching for them. They're still stuck in this mud of nonsense. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I still don't know what to do about it at this point.
Well, I think I have some ideas. I know you have some ideas. And I think that some of it is going to have to be done on a smaller scale also. I think what I envision, and we'll speak behind the scenes, even with what Afrinert, what I had intended it to be, it's not where it needs to be. I think, listen, I would like to have our site revamped where we are essentially a hub for your product, for all these other products you're mentioning. It's got to be a we don't even really have a place that's solid enough for people to say, okay, this is where you go to get all of these things. Now,
right.
For the minstrel stuff, they have that. Okay,
that
stuff exists.
Yeah.
We know, you know exactly where to go to get everything that is more of a kind of a degrading nature. I mean, when it comes down to a ghetto-wise or ghetto-centric product, you know where to go. But for the product, for this, what we're offering, there really is no such thing. So I will speak with you behind the scenes. We're going to do this because it has to be done. And maybe even if it comes down to a really nice-looking website, at least people know this is where you go to get Brandon Easton's works, maybe the late Dwayne McDuffie's works. There's got to be a place. So I even think of like when you think of Miles Morales, the character that's the ultimate Spider-Man. There's no T-shirts, no real T-shirts for him. There's no. I mean, why would you make? And this is to Marvel. We've got to look at collaborating with Marvel and DC for some of their black characters. Because why are you making a Black Lightning if you can't sell a Black Lightning T-shirt to a young black male? Or young black, brown male, or white male, for that matter. Because I tell you something else. When I was at the New York Comic Con, there's a gentleman. I should shout out his website. He's got a little business now. It's called Black Action Tees. Black Action Tees.
I have some of his.
Now, well, listen. That Black Panther with the Batman 1960s logo. It's hot to death. I saw white people buying that because it was cool. There were white people at his booth buying black imagery products, just like it was a multiracial participation in that. But he made, he built it, and then they will come. That's part of the problem also, is that what we spoke about earlier, these things are being, these people, you know, when they're created, listen, we're seeing more women. We have female friends that are part of our crew, even when we see the upcoming Winter Soldier movie.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, our female friends are coming up to myself, Captain Kirk, I know, Daryl B. Oh, who is this Ultron? Even before Ultron movie was even spoken about, they said, well, I've been reading about these Avengers. They're asking, I went to Wikipedia. I had a conversation having to explain a whole bunch of stuff because now they're interested. Collecting comic books, I said, wait a minute. This is like a soap opera. These are serialized products. How come girls aren't in here? 25 years later, they're in there.
They're making up like 40% of the consumer market pace, at least in the movie theaters.
But guess what? They built it, then they came. The same thing. So you see women, all of a sudden, people have to pay attention to female nerds. They have to pay attention to them. Black nerds can be should be representative of the same that same dynamic. Why not? When we went to the Schomburg thing, I didn't go to the first. I wanted to, but I missed the first year. The second year, I was sweating like a pig because it was so packed. God knows what's going to happen for the third year. No one sees these people. The all I saw was bespectacled versions of myself walking around. I mean, there's no camera there to videotape this. Afro nerd, I'm going to say this to our own horn. We should have had cameras in there recording that event and having it posted on the internet on afronerd.com, which we should do by next year. There's got to be, or even imagine if there was some kind of a live telecast of that function, like all these other functions. We got to start thinking larger, so people know. Wow, I didn't know, you know. And I've had white colleagues tell me when they heard there was such a thing as a Black Comic Con, they said, "Well, am I allowed to go?" I said, "What do you mean you're allowed? You can go wherever you want to go." That's another factor too. When some whites are interested in black product, but when it's labeled black, they think that they can't partake because you know, well, they think it's for us and not for everyone. I'm selling these products for everyone, not just black and brown people. We have a caller, by the way. Again, folks, we had an extended thing. Speaking of Mr. Brandon Easton, let's go to the calls. 703, welcome to the comic shop. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Hey, how you guys doing? It's me, Black Ronin.
Hey, hi, Black. Okay, case in point. Go ahead.
Well, I called in because I know you were saying about how there's no place that sells black comic literature and material. There actually is a site. I remember founding it on Hero Talk. Remember Hero Talk back in the day?
Oh, yeah, I remember. I was begging that guy. Why did that guy refuse to make that into a business? I don't know why.
I'm with you. I'm with you 100%.
That was the hub right there, and he didn't want
it. Was. That's where I saw a lot of information about independent artists. Brandon Easton, I'm sorry, how you doing, man? I think, posted in there as well. I mean, that's where I found out a lot about a lot of black independent comics and stuff. And a couple of guys, one of the guys from that site, created a site that houses, like, where you can find, you know, trade paperbacks of, like, Black Panther. He has, like, Marvel, DC, independent. He has books for kids. It's called Afri Comics. I have to send you the link.
Oh, I know Afri Comics. Yeah, I do know. I heard of it. I'm aware. Yeah, Afri Comics. You're right. I know about Afri Comics.
But I agree with you. I think the bigger issue is that, you guys' show is and what you're talking about doing with the show, I've helped out. I'm here in the D.C. area, outside of D.C. with B.A. I know he's over there. Black Achievement's over in Maryland. Bison for Life is over somewhere down here at B.A. as well. Let's start making chapters of Afro Nerd all over the country. That's what I say. Let's start chapters. Just start chapter.
Well, you know
what?
Listen,
you know?
I would love to say, I'm a Anglophile. Wouldn't mind seeing an Afro Nerd UK also. The young lady I met last year,
yep.
Afro Brit. She was so intrigued by the show and really a supporter of the show that when she came from London to New York, she shouted me out and said, "Listen, I got to meet you." So I met her, and this is a person from London. We had people from Tokyo Mike.
Exactly.
Incessantly on this show, and he's a black man in Tokyo listening. So sometimes you have to kind of, you know, hey, as a matter of fact, you had Bison listen from the show because he was in Iraq listening to Afro-Nerd Radio.
So we kind of have to realize
we had Canadians listen to the show. We have folks from, Netherlands listening. So, you know, we're not really taking advantage of making this a collective spirit.
That's the problem.
One more thing.
I think that's the problem.
Just me shout out to the captain. You know, we're supposed to be doing Afro Radio in like 4 minutes. I think we're just going to extend it up to the rest of the hour and we're just going to kick it. Brandon, you still have time?
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. No problem.
Yeah. Okay. Because normally we do a split show, the Comic Shop and an Afro Radio. Daryl, you can sit in as well. We're just going to keep on flowing like this, and we're trying to get into other topics as well. We're just going to have this as a round table, our own Knights of the Round Table, black version. to really discuss some of this stuff.
As long as
I'm not
Martin Lawrence. Don't make me Martin Lawrence in this. We're good.
You'll never be Martin Lawrence for this. Don't worry about it.
I'm Pete Reese.
Black, I like what you said, man. And, Afri Comics, I do remember that site. But I also remember I simply, in my head one day, I said, well, you know, where does a black person look for, like, black representation in comics? I Googled Hero Talk and BlackSuperhero.com because I was actively looking for that. And it was upsetting that he kind of closed shop on that, and I even remember asking him, why don't you try to, make this into a business model? You know, he just didn't want to do it.
There are other sites out there. I mean, I've found quite a few sites because I know – I mean, of course, I'm a long-time listener to your show, and Hero Talk introduced me to a lot of different, I found a lot of different links. I bought some stuff from people who collaborated. Some people who make collaborations in Hero Talk. They do independent books. They're street teams. They got a video game, and they got a comic. I wish they had kept doing a comic going. There were a couple of different, creators and everything. But the problem is that part of what Brandon said was that, I think for some things that happened on Hero Talk, there were ego problems going on there. I mean, even I was starting to read about it as going through the site consistently, where people were trying to collaborate on stuff. Some people were able to get some stuff started off, but it seemed like people always tend to stop what they're doing. Like take Kevin Garreau. I remember his first Dark Storm Studios he started doing. I bought some of his early books. But then all of a sudden he got with Marvel, and he kind of like stopped doing what he was doing on his own. At least that's the way it came across to me. And I've seen that with other creators as well. They start out looking independent. They get a little press. Jeremy Love is another guy. Jeremy Love is another guy. Start doing some stuff online. They get to Hollywood, and all of a sudden, or to get into, Marvel brings them in, or somebody else brings them in. And next thing you know, they stop doing their independent thing. They're working full time on a Marvel thing, and then it just kind of dwindles out. You don't hear from them really again, I mean, I know he did I Frankenstein. I know he did a couple other things, but I mean, I was really liking the stuff he was doing on his own with more black characters and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, he did like one book, and after that, it just fizzled out. And I kept looking for other issues, other products, other something, and I'm like, okay, well, I mean, isn't this what you got you noticed in the first place? I mean, you got to kind of keep doing that,
Well, I tell you what, I think we took a hit when Dwayne McDuffie died, because he was a guy out there that was so prolific and so radical. I mean, really pushing that. And then it died a relatively young man. And I'm gonna have to look at Brandon and others to kind of pick up the baton. All of us have to pick up Mr. McDuffie's baton, to be honest with you. We're going to have to, because he started this thing. And actually, listen, he infused a lot of black product But he also put out product for everyone, not just.
Yeah.
You know, he crossed over without losing his inner soul, his inner culture. He was still promoting kind of a black thing, a blackness.
Mm-hmm.
I want to pose a question to Brandon. What do you think about? I mean, I'm more. This is like my hope. What about Milestone Media? You see how Image stuck it out. Now Image Image has had this whole genre comics thing. Image is a player now. Not that they haven't been in the past, but people are really looking at them now. They're getting movie deals. They're getting TV deals. Their books are flying off the shelf. When you go to the comic book shops, folks cannot talk enough about Image. And I'm saying to myself, what if Milestone had remained a force in the same manner, where we could have seen a multiracial product with genre comics the same way that Image is. Now, because Image, you know, it was okay. You know, I was buying some of the product, but now, totally different thing.
Right.
I mean,
well,
do you think Milestone can return, or should we be looking at something to redoing or doing something similar to a Milestone imprint?
Okay. Yeah, there's two separate things I wanted to talk about. Okay, first, let's start with Image. Image, in its inception and even now, has the benefit of having creators who have established themselves at Marvel and DC first. So they were able to take large chunks of the audience away from the typical superhero stuff and then apply it to the early days of Image. Then, as the years have gone by, take a really close look at the type of people who actually are getting all the deals. These are not usually people out of the blue at Image, you know, who, like an independent creator no one's ever heard of. Like, you've got, you know, Brian K. Vaughan and Brian Wood and, you know, the Robert Kirkman types. You've got, you know, like Brian Azzarello and Warren Ellis. I mean, you've got names of people who had such a following that they were able to bring it to Image. Because ultimately, all they really want to do is sell comics. And if Brian K. Vaughan, you know, obviously did so much at Vertigo and regular DC, he did Saga, which is, you know, burning up the charts right now. But he was able to bring that audience with him. Now, with Milestone, I can't really speak too much because I hear different stuff about Milestone all the time, and I'm not, you know, legally involved in whatever's going on with them. I understand that, in theory, Milestone still exists. I don't know what's going on with them because they had a very specific deal back in the day with DC that allowed them to get that distribution that got their work in front of so many people. I don't know what's going on now, and because I know some of the people involved, so I really can't speak too much about that. However, they're without crossing any crazy lines, I will say this. I think a lot of people are going to be surprised, particularly black comic book geeks. I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by some events of the fall of 2014. I'll put it like that.
Well, all right. I know Milestone still exists, but it just seems like I like the way Image has really grown, and I would have liked to have seen Milestone, even though I know it's still, like, I'm aware that it still exists, but not in the way that it came out in 93.
Having a deal with DC made all the difference in the world. I mean, it came out, first of all, you know, Milestone came out at a time, and Image, too, when people were still buying comic books in large numbers with the expectation that they would be worth a lot of money. That was what we called, if you remember, the speculator boom. You know, we are no longer in a speculator boom. So back when, you know, Spider-Man number one, written and drawn by Todd McFarlane, sold 5 million copies, and then Youngblood sold, you know, 5 million copies, and then, you know, X-Force number one, all that. You know, you had all these people buying millions of comic books. So it was a preheated oven that Milestone could, you know, expand within. So obviously having people like, you know, Dwayne McDuffie and Mike Davis and Dennis Cohen and Christopher Priest, who was, you know, involved early on, and a lot of people don't want to talk about that side of it. But, you know, having all those really powerful names and really intelligent creators doing stuff early on made a huge difference too. So, you know, at that time, dropping Milestone Comics in 1993, back when comics were selling millions of copies a month, you know, they were able to get, number one, a market base. Then they had the distribution deal through DC Comics.
and that got them in every comic book store in the country. So the difference is now people who own comic book stores are terrified of ordering anything they don't know. And that's a whole other thing we don't talk about too much in the industry, but the retailers have an immense amount of power. But retailers are being squeezed dry by Diamond, and retailers are also being squeezed dry by some of the bigger companies that demand that they order certain things so they can make their rent. So, who? I mean, if you had a choice between, let's say, my book and then, you know, X-Men written by Brian Michael Bendis, you know, they're going to order X-Men written by Brian Michael Bendis. So this is one of the reasons why you're not seeing a brand new black company just explode, because you do need names and you do need readership and you need a distribution deal. With those three things, you get the sky's the limit. But what we're doing now is taking it one step at a time. As I said before, I think a lot of fans are going to be very excited about some things in fall of 2014.
Yes,
that's good to hear.
Also, we have a caller.
Oh,
hold
go
on,
ahead.
We got a call. We've been holding for a long time. 510, welcome to the Comic Shop / Avenue Radio Extended. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from. 510.
My name is Thaddeus Howes, and I'm calling from California.
Welcome, Thaddeus.
Welcome.
And I wanted to get a shout out to Brandon. Hey, Brandon, how you doing?
Hey, Thaddeus, how you doing, man? Good to hear you.
I'm good to hear you too, old man.
I've been listening to you fellas talk for a while, and you know, the thing you guys were talking about earlier, I think, is going to be the thing that makes a difference, is an understanding of population and density. You guys are trying to sell to a market that's only 1/6 the size of all of America, and I think if we want to win this game, we're going to have to get out of America. We're going to have to get out of this nation and sell our stuff everywhere else. Australia loves science fiction. They love it. They eat it like candy. Japan, they love it too, although it's strange there, but it's still well-loved. Europe and France, not so much, but France has always had a history of loving sci-fi. If you can make something strange and awesome, they'll buy it. So maybe the secret for us to be successful is to stop depending on America to pay our bills. Go overseas. That's my mission. My mission as a writer is to start looking overseas, looking at other places, looking at people who don't think like Americans. Because as a writer, I find when I've written stuff, people in foreign countries really like my work. So it's like, okay, I don't care if Americans don't like it. I'll sell it somewhere else.
That's an interesting
point. And I want to say that Thaddeus has a website called Hub City Blues. He is a really good science fiction writer. He's another young brother. Well, I don't know how old he is, but he's another brother out there who I would definitely recommend his work. I bought his collection of short stories. Excellent stuff. So he's another person who folks could take a look at.
Well, repeat that again, and we can promote it here. You said Hub City?
Hub City Blues. HubCityBlues.com.
I'll check it out, and I will patronize. I'll say
this
much.
I would check it out, too.
Listen, this is the Internet, and I agree with what he's saying, but I also think that we try so hard to fall into this whole monolithic mindset, not unlike the Eternals Unimind. I'm going to keep it real nerdy. The Unimind, if everyone reads read Kirby's Eternals, everyone gets together in one mindset, literally, one pulsating brain. We're not that way. You know, there are multiple cultures, multiple types of black folks into different things. So I think we need to stop acting like we're one group. One example is the Afropunk Festival that we promote here, and hopefully we'll have Ms. Jocelyn Cooper, who runs Afropunk, to come through. Now, these are black folk and hipsters of all hues that are, and Daryl knows about this stuff intimately. They go against the grain all the time. There's the black folks that, for all intents and purposes, are listening to metal, they're listening to progressive hip-hop, they're listening to punk, they're listening to urban alternative, they're coming by the thousands every year in Brooklyn. And it's covered in the New York Times, and you're led to believe, well, black folks don't listen to rock and roll. But how do they explain 40,000 to 60,000 people showing up every weekend in August. Mostly, like, at least 90% of them are black and brown extraction, listening to all intents and purposes, not conventional hip-hop. But no one is exploring. Now, we are going to work with her people because there's a common thread, a common spirit, or a kindred spirit. But at some point, I understand what the gentleman's saying, but there's people in America that just aren't being represented. They're not being called to. The focus is not there for them. And yet hundreds, if not thousands of people, the Schomburg was a packed house. There was no cameras there to really say, well, look at this. BET wasn't there. You know, TV1 wasn't there. I mean, you know,
and that's part
of the problem, too.
And I'll say I'm living proof. I used to be the only black guy at a Metallica concert here in New York. The only black guy. Used to be the only black guy on the punk scene for a long time at some of the spots I would hang. Now, half the crowd's black. Half the crowd's
Metallica,
Latino.
Right?
You know?
At Metallica.
I'm just saying. In my experiences, I used to go into the crowd and have guys look at me strange like, hey, dude, Run DMC concerts the other way. Hey, man, you're in the wrong spot. LL Cool J is down the street. And then when I start reciting the words to Enter Sandman alongside of him, after a while, color didn't matter. Color didn't matter. I'm there as a fan, and I'm rocking out with him. And slowly but surely, more people took hold. Slowly but surely, more people found it was a fun time. Slowly but surely, the music spoke to them. That's all I'm saying about it on the literature and on the visual side of the medium. All we have to do, all right, and again, I can understand, hey, I know whenever I visit Trinidad, my parents' homeland, whenever I go to other places, when I was in the military going to other places, I would have comics and novels with me, and people would look at me strange, and then I'd tell them what the novel or the comic was about and what the themes were, and boom, we're into like an hour conversation about the book and the characters. I didn't cease to be the strange black guy reading something that we didn't think black guys read. I became, hey, he's a fan. That's all I'm saying. If we expose more people to it, hey, we'll have a growing movement.
That's the truth. Yeah, that's the truth right there. I mean, it's a great lie. I mean, it's a great lie about dividing people. That's what that's about. I mean, and part of this, you can say part of this, the media machine is a part of it. You know, the cultural machine is a Western mindset to always divide and categorize people and put them into cells. But I mean, I think on individual level, we tend to break down barriers quicker by just explaining the things that we're interested in, and people are attracted to it, just like Daryl said.
Let me bring the other gentleman back in, I think, from 510. I know we're getting some feedback from where he is. I did want to mention one other thing also. I want to pose a question out there, because we went to another program. We're extending it. What do you think happened with Aaron Magruder? We're hearing that Aaron Magruder has left Boondock, at least for this season. I know he has Black Jesus coming out. I'm intrigued about that on Cartoon Network. I think that's a live-action thing, though. So let me go to Daryl, actually, this time. Daryl, what do you think is behind this? People are going to history when it comes to, well, when a creator leaves the show usually just sucks. So what do you think is going on with Magruder not being a part of this?
I think he's always been complicated. He's admitted so himself in his Boondocks treasuries. When he writes, he says, you know what, it's a hard thing for me to do this. My mind goes in many different places, you know, and a lot of times friends and foes alike won't like what I'm thinking about. You know, I will say something. I'm out there. I'm very blunt. Well, this was his, you know what? I think Boondocks could survive without me. Let me put out this Black Jesus project. I think that's what it was. He got burnt out on Boondocks. And a lot of the cast and the writers of Boondocks said, you know what, I think we can handle it. Go ahead, do your thing, man. Do what you have to do. As a result, on the Black Jesus Project, he got a lot of the people that are with Boondocks on that also. So it's going to be like Boondocks from two separate themes, two separate directions. We're going to get a lot of the same themes in both of them. One's live action, one's cartoon. But I just think simply I think Brandon can speak about this himself, but Magruder loved the fame and loathed the fame at the same time from Boondocks. People latched on to Boondocks for a lot of the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it sort of went, I thought I was making something to uplift and make people think, and here's this element that latched on to it because of this, because of that. And they totally ignored the whole point of what I was trying to get at.
Sound like Dave Chappelle.
Brandon, you have any thoughts on that? Do you think it's Mr. Chappelle? You think
to be absolutely honest with you, man. I was saying, to be absolutely honest with you, I don't know anything about that situation, because for all the people who I know who I think are associated with him, to a lot of people also, this was really shocking news. I honestly could not tell you anything about it because I've never met Aaron Magruder. One of my colleagues, a brother named LaShawn Thomas, was the animation director or character director.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that for I think season two or three.
I remember
the
credits. Her name on the credits, yeah.
Yeah, so I honestly don't know. I mean, I have never met Aaron Magruder in my life. I only know people who work with him. Everybody has a different opinion about the guy. So I can't even speculate, bro. I hope that whatever happened was harmonious, but it doesn't seem that way. But for anybody to create a show and then not be on it, you know, as it continues, I can't imagine what that feels like, and I can't imagine that feels good. So, you know, more power to that brother, but, you know, unfortunately, I don't know anything about that situation.
Yeah, Tim Kringen Heroes calling line four.
we got another caller here, by the way. I think I know who this person is. He's another person who might have some insight. Sergio, is that you?
Yes, that's right. It's me. In terms of the Aaron Magruder situation, I agree with what you just said. I think he was burnt out. There's some talk that he was forced out. I doubt that. I don't think so. I don't think the show would survive. I recall in Living Color, when Winans left the show, it went straight into the toilet. It was pathetic. Because like in Living Color, Boondocks is the singular creation of a vision, and it's hard to get someone who has, in effect, the same vision as the creator does. Who's even going to do the voices? I don't know. It's like Ren and Stimpy. When the guy left the show, wasn't the same. I don't know what's going to happen.
The vocal talent is still involved, though. I think it's just Magruder. He's stepping down.
Okay, but still, you need his vision. You know, you can try to imitate him. Will it be compromised? Because he pulled no punches at all. No punches at all. Will the people, and I don't know, who is taking over the show? Who is the new executive producer? Who are the writers? Will it still have that same bite? I don't know. Everybody's going to want to see it.
My problem with Magruder is that, well, first of all, I tried to get Magruder on the show a few times, and he doesn't like to do interviews. He's kind of a curmudgeon, and he seems like the kind of guy that doesn't really want to promote his product. I thought that Boondocks. Matter of fact, I think what's the actress that's on? What's her name? Live action actress also from 2007.
Regina King.
Repeat that again.
Regina King.
I still didn't hear. Regina King.
She's the voice of Huey and Riley, yeah.
Right. Regina King had said something about, she said something about the merchandising, like she felt like he was dropping the ball on some things. There's some things that could have been done to really, so in my estimation, even though I had issues with the N-word even though at some point, at the famous MLK coming back to life, I thought the use was appropriate at that point. I thought I was biting, as opposed. But sometimes his usage of the N-word seemed to be kind of based on being somewhat salacious, as opposed to really using it politically. I thought that particular episode, MLK coming back to seeing a minstrel black existed, yes, he would have used the N-word. I could see that. I thought that was an excellent episode. But I think he's a difficult kind of guy, personally. He just comes off that way.
You can argue, as was mentioned, that he had a love-hate relationship with fame, that he was uncomfortable with it. I can understand why. I have met him. I met him a couple of years ago. He was a very nice, very approachable person. He really was, at least to me. But he probably was very uncomfortable with the fame. He probably felt that if he had any marketing or merchandising of the product, somehow he was compromising his work, his talent, you know, because clearly he sees the show as a way of commentary against the status quo. And if you merchandise and start selling off, you know, figurines and lunch boxes, then somehow now you're compromising with the status quo. It could be. You know, he, like I said, like it was mentioned, he probably is, most likely is, a very, very complicated character. All we can do is wait and see when the new episodes premiere next month and see what happens.
So, Sergio, essentially he was our version of Bill Waterston.
Who's Bill Waterston?
For Calvin and
Hobbes. Yeah, explain it to me.
That was one of his idols, I think. That was one of his heroes, I think, I believe, Bill Waterston.
Yeah, Bill Waterston and Charles Schulz.
Both of them.
He said Boondocks was supposedly in their vision, except with, of course, a decidedly black take on it. So, you know, I agree with Regina King. There was marketing opportunities that they could have done with this show, and the platform could have been used to grow his brand more. But like I said before, like Sergio said, like Brandon said, you know, that there comes a point with creators where you look at your vision and you see guys latching on for the wrong reasons, or people loving it for the wrong reasons, and you go, what did I do this for again?
Well, maybe it wasn't even much that, gentlemen. It might have simply been that he looked at it, saw what he created, and realized it was no longer what he started with. The whole nature of Huey as a character is counterculture and counter to everything that they were talking about, marketing it, selling it, boxing it, compiling it. I mean, it's... Huey is Magruder, and I think that he would be opposed to the very nature of what they wanted to do. So I'm not surprised that Magruder walked away from it. I'm actually surprised he stayed as long as he did.
Yeah, I saw a lot of that, too. I'm a big fan of the Boondocks from the very beginning. I mean, I used to have the little clipping of the strip up in my cubicle when I first started working, and people would come by, check it out, and ask me, what's that? I'm like, that's the Boondocks, you know, and kind of give them a little – 2-minute spiel, whether, you know, depending on what race they were or whatever. And even when the show stuck, even watching the old episodes now of the first couple of seasons, I still don't have the third season. I got to get that. But the whole vision of the show isn't what was in the comic strip. I mean, they really watered it. Yeah, my opinion, they really watered down Huey a lot. They really upplayed the granddad and Riley's antics. And I think a lot of that is what people started to latch on to. And that was more the minstrel element he was trying to fight against, but he didn't have Huey as strong of a, you know, black power voice as he was in the comics and everything. I mean, it was much more extreme, even for a comic strip that's written in, you know, Sunday papers and everything. And, I mean, it just seemed to me like the other producers on the show, I think it was Carl Jones or some other people, it seemed to me they kind of added that extra, to me, a little bit of a underlying of what Bieber calls the minstrel element in there, and a lot of people kind of latched on to that. So I would hear people talking about it, how big fans they were of it, but I'm like, well, that's not really the Boondocks. I mean, yeah, it's on television, but you look at the early comic strip, there's a lot of differences there. There's a lot of differences, a lot of things he touched on. that weren't
for you. Know, you can have a situation that happened with Community. The guy who created Community, whose name I cannot remember now, they forced him off the show. Everybody said that that season without him was the worst season ever. It was awful. And NBC had no choice but to bring him back to save the show because it was a disaster. And from what I hear, the show has come back to what it was, maybe even better than some of the previous seasons. That's what I've heard from people I know who are real fans of the show. It could be a situation where Magruder was they basically forced Magruder's hand and he had to leave because, as you mentioned, it seems like more and more the creative control was taken out from his hands. So why stay there? Now, as I said before, if it turns out that the show is going to be awful this new season, they want to keep the show and keep it going. They may have no choice but to bring him back and give him more full control, like as previously.
Well, I want to say also, there seems to be this common thread or a common element where there's a conflict between those who create and those who are the business people. We've seen this time and time again. When you deal with one of my favorite genres of music, where I thought that the music landscape was going to change for the better was when neo-soul came about in the late 90s. When neo-soul came out, I was like, okay, we're turning the corner. So I started seeing a kind of an Afrocentrism. I'm seeing instrumentation. You had clubs to go to. There was a whole mm-hmm. People, you know, it really was a counter or an alternative to hip-hop, even to the hip-hop of that period. But the artists themselves were always fighting the term neo-soul. They didn't want to be called that. And I was a little frustrated because, listen, the business person has to figure out a way to disseminate your art to the masses. Kadar Massenburg, who was behind the neo-soul movement, he had this difficulty with always relating to the artist fighting the business out of it. So this is, I think, a problem even with Magruder, is that I understand – Huey and how he represents him, and even Huey P. Newton to a certain degree, it is a counterculture thing. But at the same time, all children, and specifically children of color, need to have some kind of black imprint. When I go to Comic-Con, it would be nice to see some kind of black imprint there, because we have our own imprint. For black pop culture, there is a black culture lineage. If you factor in the 70s blaxploitation heroes, some of them who are still alive, and that imagery that has made folks like Quentin Tarantino a multimillionaire. See, you see what happens with black imagery, how it can also influence people who are not black. So you have that as an imprint. You have straight up black heroes that DC, Marvel, and Image have created. You have Aaron Magruder's work. You have Black Dynamite, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. That should be under one umbrella as a black pop culture imprint. Where are we going with this? But if you have artists fighting it, saying, "Well, I don't want to promote Boondocks," then who are you making Boondocks for? I see the frustration from the business aspect. I can see how they're frustrated with the artist. I'm sorry.
But I don't agree with that, see, because I don't think that ultimately when you look at a product, if I'm a creator and I create a product and I tell you this product sells because I produce it this way, and then you tell me I can sell it better if you change this, are you selling my product or are you now selling this new thing? And then when you create your new thing and it doesn't sell, what do you go back and blame? You go back and blame the creator, or you go back and blame the marketing person. No, everybody goes back and blames the creator. They say, well, you shouldn't have sold out. You shouldn't have changed your dream. You shouldn't have changed your product. So, you know, the creator is put between the rock and the hard place. If he creates what he creates and it sells, and then you want to change it because you think you'll market it better, and he changes it and then it doesn't sell, whose fault is that?
I wasn't asking for changing. I agree with you on that. Matter of fact, with Issa Rae, if I remember correctly, she became popular from the internet from her Awkward Black Girl series. All of a sudden, when HBO, from what I hear, Sarah could probably talk about this, they said, well, we'll take you on, but we want to make the character, you, essentially, make you lighter complexion. They want to make all these changes. And wait a minute. It is called Awkward Black Girl. That's what it is. But they wanted to change it, even though it was successful to some degree in its current incarnation. So I agree with you. I don't think that things need to be changed. I just think that you just have to figure out, be creative on the business side on figuring out how to sell what she has to offer. But I don't agree that people should change the product. No. Sell the product is different than changing it. Serge, you were going to say something?
No, you're right about that. You're exactly right about that. I mean, she has all kind of other projects now currently in development. She even has a deal now with Shonda Rhimes to develop a show together. But right, she was adamant about – she was one of the original contributors to Shadow and Act back in the day. She had a vision. She had a singular vision. She had a voice, a uniquely different voice, a voice you really hadn't seen before in media. And
right.
When they tried to compromise her, she said, absolutely not. Then what's the point of making it?
Let's see, now, does she get the same? Because I look at her in a way not unlike Lena Dunham. Now, Lena Dunham is getting all these accolades for being this quirky white girl on HBO. She can be naked as she wants to be. Not that anyone wants to see that, but they keep...
No, please, no.
You know what? They can indulge, but look what they indulge. They will indulge her eccentricity. But
you see, here's the thing about Lena Dunham. What got her over was that she had a patron. She had Judd Apatow. Judd Apatow, the guy who created Knocked Up, directed Knocked Up, and This Is 40, and all those comedies that he's executive produced and he's directed, he's a major name in films and in the business. And what happened was that when he latched on to her, she was made. She was made, right? So therefore, what Issa Rae needed to really get her over, she needed a major name. Like I said before, now she's with Shonda Rhimes, but they're doing something separately. But if someone like Shonda Rhimes at the beginning of her show or Oprah Winfrey had gotten behind her, then she would have had the clout to say, I can do whatever I want to do. But she didn't have that. Not like Lena. Who was Lena Dunham? I haven't even heard of Lena Dunham. She made one little movie called Tiny Furniture that nobody saw. But Judd Apatow saw it and said, she's a genius. What do you want to do? I'm behind you.
And she garnered a $3 million book deal. And she's, what, 28 years old?
But that's the secret
that
right
the
there.
Show came out. That was after the show came out. After the show came out, then everybody wanted her. Right. But that's what Issa Rae, you see, that's what black talent has to understand, that a lot of times if you have a patron, someone who's going to support you no matter what, that goes a long way. That's what white people understand. That's what we got to understand.
Wait, it's not just about the patron, though. The other half of that equation is the startup mentality. Startup mentality says fail, 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 learn. They're willing to fail. They have the money to fail. They have the opportunity to make mistakes and learn from them. We generally don't have that kind of money. We make a mistake, we lose our whole game. They can make a mistake. They've got money. They've got patrons. They've got support. This gives them an advantage because they can experiment again and again and again until they get it right.
It'll relate.
You know, you got a point. No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
You are right. You do have a point. Yes, you do. You do have a point. That is correct.
In a related note, friends of Chris Rock, friends of Oprah, you see this roundtable discussion Afro Nerd can do? We sell at a very low price to be on. We can be on like 12 a.m., 1 a.m. with this kind of roundtable discussion. We'll hit any topic. We'll get as heated as we are tonight. Just our own personal ad.
Well, listen, you know, Daryl said something that frustrates me, and this is why, you know, when we interviewed Jocelyn Cooper of Afropunk, she reached out to us and said, listen, maybe we can collaborate. And I've been in discussions with her back and forth about helping her, helping us. Because the bottom line is, even this type of discourse We can't hear this. You're more accustomed to hearing someone like Steve Harvey. I know Q Storm is listening. He doesn't like it, but Steve Harvey is able to succeed with what he does. And in the morning, it's as if black folks can't get any information. We can't get information. I mean, listen, I've noticed even with satellite radio and Sergio's a satellite subscriber, they have EW. If you know this, Sergio, they have EW channel. They have all this pop culture discussion. And I'm sitting here, I'm going through my head, because I know Daryl does this, the captain. We have black pop culture discussions in our heads all day long. We're inundated with all these projects, some are much more visibility, and some are lesser known. But imagine a show where we can highlight these creators like Brandon, like David Walker, and others, some of the folks from the Milestone crew. I mean, if you start to really actually tally all the talent that's out there that needs to be promoted, that's a show.
That's
all this new music, all this new music that is not the T.I. and Chris Brown and all that and 2 Chainz and all that kind of nonsense. There's a flip side to all that nonsense. That is another revenue stream. No one wants – you hear crickets. We're always pulling. Believe it, we can get a fat white woman to be on TV on HBO and get $3 million checks. But we can't get this other content. For some reason, black and – truth be told, black and white corporate guys scratch their heads and they can't figure it out. That's the insulting part.
Hey, no one knows what's going to hit popular on the popular mainstream. Like Captain always says, it's all about the green. The problem is no one has an exact figure as to what is going to hit the green. And unfortunately, 9 times out of 10, it's the lowest common denominator that's the thing that hits the green. To our frustration.
Well, you know, it goes back to that book the screenwriter William Goldman wrote, "This Ventures in the Screen Trade," and that famous quote in the book that everybody copies is that in the film business, nobody knows anything. People think they know, but nobody knows anything. Believe it or not, 3 years ago, people were talking about they will never make films about slavery. Nobody wants to see a film about slavery. Now what? Gee, we got 12 Years of Slave. What else would we have? Movies about slavery. Jesus Christ. You know, it only takes one. It only takes one film for the flood, for, you know, the dams to burst. Nobody knows anything. They but they don't.
Hey, can you still hear me? Hello?
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. No, I wanted to jump in because you guys said a couple wanted to elaborate on, particularly in regard to Lena Dunham and all the business stuff. Nation. So, real quick.
Yeah.
And almost all that show is a legacy.
I think you need to move your location in your house.
That,
your reception's getting poor.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Something about
radio.
Yeah.
So,
for some reason,
okay. Lena Dunham, pretty much our entire cast.
My phone
and
my iPod.
Hello?
Uh oh.
So, yeah, I'm picking up another conversation.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, that's me.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I was saying Lena Dunham and her entire cast are all legacies, meaning that their parents were all music or TV or film industry professionals. And that
Brian Williams' daughter is on the show.
Yeah, and also David Mamet's daughter. You know,
David Mamet's daughter.
The acclaimed playwright, you know, and screenwriter. You know, and... You can't discount the immense impact being a legacy has, because a lot of people like to criticize Will Smith for pushing his kid and his kids, actually. But if you take a look at the list of people who are popular celebrities, with the exception of maybe 5 or 6 people, the majority of them are actually either legacies in the sense of direct descendants, as in sons and daughters of like either producers or former celebrities, or they're like nephews, nieces, and cousins of former celebrities or producers or directors. So, Lena Dunham's case, she really – what's that?
I said Joss Whedon represents that. His father and grandfather were screenwriters.
Yes.
Exactly.
J.J. Abrams.
Real quick.
J.J. Abrams struggled with the screenwriter.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, another thing you want to think about, now you were talking about animation earlier in regards to the Boondocks. I will say this much. The one thing I learned working on Thundercats and also to a lesser extent on Transformers Rescue Bots is that the business side dominates a lot of the creative material in the sense that a lot of the final content is ultimately determined, particularly for boys action adventure animation, is ultimately determined by how many action figures you'll sell. I'll give you an example. When I first went to the very first meeting I ever had, they were asking me about some ideas, and I threw out a couple of crazy ideas like Blade Runner-style ideas, because Blade Runner is like one of my absolute favorite things of all time. And we bounced back and forth. We had a great conversation, right? And what wound up happening was, at the end of the conversation, everybody stopped smiling and laughing and was like, yeah, but we'll never do that. And I'm like, why not? And the producer said, well, because we can't make a toy out of it. And I said, holy crap. And my whole TV animation viewing life flashed before my eyes, you know. And I used to be one of the world's biggest Transformers fans. I'm not so much now, but I used to be ridiculous about it. And when I met one of the producers from Beast Wars back at Comic-Con in 1999, he explained, because I was really mad about something that I went up to him after the panel, and I said, well, you know, why did you do this to this character? Where is Optimus Prime? Where is Megatron? Blah, 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 blah. And he's like, look, man, these toys have nothing to do with that. It was never meant to have anything to do with that. And the only reason why we tied in, you know, Beast Wars with the original Generation 1 was because people wouldn't stop complaining about it. And also Hasbro realized they could probably find a way to remold the old plastic toys and resell them, which, you know, worked to an extent. So, you know, the business side of it is incredibly powerful. Another good example would be Adventure Time. The reason why that show dominates so much on Cartoon Network is because their ancillary material, the backpacks, the pencil cases, the beach towels, the lunch boxes, they sell through the roof. You know, I don't know why there wasn't any Boondocks merchandise on that level, but they definitely missed a boat in terms of merchandising because that could have really turned it around.
Well, we learned that when we interviewed Dwayne McDuffie. Dwayne McDuffie, a few years ago, right before he passed, he was on our show, and he said that Static Shock, and to our listening audience, you can definitely go to the archives and listen to that program. He had said that Static Shock was one of the most highly rated programs, I think, was it a WB at that time. And they were difficulties in selling toys on that. And he says what it really boils down to. And I think even the problems with the Justice League, his involvement with the Justice League, even though that lasted for a long time, there was always the background of we got to sell products off of these cartoons. So you're definitely right about that. We've been aware of that for a long time. My only thing is now we have more outlets for stuff. PlayStation, Xbox, they're providing content now. Powers, we didn't talk about this. Powers is, I believe the live action version. At first, I thought it might have been a cartoon, but I believe there's going to be a live action version of Powers that FX is supposed to be doing. PlayStation is getting that. So if that's the case, why can't we, as adult consumers of animation, the Green Lantern, all that kind of stuff that we were looking at, this faux DC Nation, this DC Nation that's really a farce. Why can't we get some of these programs on these video game consoles or anything else? Mm-hmm. Look, Orange is the New Black, and I'm not really into it because I've had enough of seeing black folk incarcerated. I just don't care about that. But I mean, it's what it is. But it's thriving on Netflix. Why can't we see some of the product, whether it's black sci-fi, black drama, something that is not, the minstrel norm? Because I think some rapper, we talked about the rapper Shorty, whatever his name was. He was about to get a show, and black folks got some common sense and shut him down. He was trying to have a reality show with him and with his 10 baby mamas, something like that. But somebody
else. Yeah, that was last year, right?
Well, you know what? They remixed it, and they came up with little Bootsy, who just got released from prison, and they're gonna do a reality show with four or five of
no,
his baby moms.
No, that's not for real. I mean, that's a test run. That's a trial balloon. No network has picked that up yet. They just got together and made it, and hopefully they think somebody will bite.
Well, God. Listen. I barely paid attention to that, Sergio, and I knew about it. I just glanced at it. Now the problem is,
but you bring up a point.
Listen, hold on. It's a test. But damn it, we got to start testing some stuff that is not so much of a degrading nature.
Okay. Do you agree? Do you think that there has been a subtle shift in terms of movies, what black people want to see? I'll give you an example. The big news last week was that how badly Tyler Perry's last movie did, his latest one,
thank God,
at the box office. Right. Mm-hmm. The lowest grossing, the discount Peebles, because he didn't write or direct that one or stars in it. That's the lowest grossing one film. But of all the films he's done, that he's written, he's directed, almost all of them, this one had the lowest gross, the lowest. You know, and this weekend is dropping even bigger. And the talk is that, and he has even said he's going to stop making films for a while. He's going to concentrate on television. Right? Is that over? Hey, look. He could go on the train. What? The only people going to show his shows is the Oprah Winfrey Network, and she needs them because she needs viewers.
That's
but didn't
point.
Didn't she sell OWN? Isn't she selling it?
No.
She still runs it. She runs it. It's her. Well, she runs it. It's being financed by Discovery Communications. It's not her money. People think it's her money. It's not her money. It's Discovery Communications, but she runs it. Right.
What's Puffy going to do? Puffy's coming up with Revolt. What's that going to be? Is that going to be revolutionary or what?
Can I say something, guys? My name is Thaddeus, and one of the things that I think we are all missing the boat. We're moving around the boat. The actual problem isn't a lack of avenues. The internet has provided and will continue to provide new avenues for us to show up in. There's video game consoles, there's Netflix, there's Hulu, there's even cities are starting to try to build their own communication protocols on their own, separate from anybody else's. You're going to start seeing more of that. The opportunity for us as writers, creators, designers, technologists, we have avenues. The issue is what we don't have is coordination. We don't have funding. We don't have patrons. We don't have a process. We don't know enough people. We have creation, but we're going to now need an infrastructure to build into. Without that infrastructure, we can create whatever we want, and no one will see it. So I challenge you as Afro nerds to go out and find, create, engineer, reverse engineer, bludgeon, bully, Vince anyone to build the infrastructure for creative people to write to create to build into. That will give us the opportunity to partake of these numerous avenues that we can all be involved in.
Well, you know something?
Channels are not gone.
Let me say one thing. Throughout this program and other programs, I've always used the term infrastructure. I've always used that term, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I'm going to be careful what I say on air, but let's put it this way. Daughter seems to be able to allow outliers the ability to get product. Even those who are not of African extraction or whatever, or minorities, they have used that. When they get the door pushing their face, they go to Kickstarter, where someone said, well, we don't understand this, and they're able to garner hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of a Kickstarter. Now, I say this, and I'm going to shut up, because we're going to have to mention this, we'll have to talk about this off air. But black folks need to think about a Kickstarter imprint. I'm going to say that, and leave it at that. Why that hasn't been done? I don't know. That would also put us in one of those situations of put up or shut up because that's something for the black community. Okay, this is literally a conduit for black folks to contribute to black products. But will we do that? I don't know. We're running out of excuses also.
Or we just need a black Christian Slater to be in his mom's basement with an illegal transmitter just broadcasting songs and anti-establishment ideas to break through every network, every internet run, everything. You know, we could hope for that too.
Listen, we spoke about this guy a few times ago. He's not a black guy. He's from the Ukraine. He lived on food stamps for a while, and he went into coding, and he came up with WhatsApp. And Zuckerberg just handed him something like, $13 billion, I think his personal fortune's about 6.8. He's only 37, 38 years old. What I'm saying, it seems like there's an element in our community where we would prefer to be bouncing basketballs and holding our genitals on stage than figuring out a way to code product and someone can hand you $1 billion. We're not even trying to push that. We're not pushing technology. This has got to stop. TheRoot.com, the last show, we highlighted the article at The Root that showcased 17 women, this is Women's History Month, 17 women, black women, that are running their own companies, that are technologists. We don't even have an infrastructure to even promote those people.
We can promote
the Real Housewives, though. Charlamagne on the Breakfast Club, hold on. Charlamagne on the Breakfast Club can promote the next minstrel TV program, but we can't seem to figure out how to highlight these young women that are technologists, or highlight Brandon Easton, or highlight all these people, or highlight Sergio Mims and ShadowAndAct.com. I mean, there's a problem with us, too.
Well, and again, this is where I hope, and again, as an aside, I hope Dr. Tyson accomplishes what he wants to accomplish with Cosmos. We're doing a lot. We can do more. But here's hoping, watching that program and watching a strong black male intelligent lead with that program sparks some of our young generation.
I got to go to a call, but I want to say one thing, and I'll let Sergio speak. Let me go to this call, though. But I go back to Mr. Harvey. Mr. Harvey is the number one black DJ, so to speak, DJ in quotes. And has he interviewed someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson? I think not. That's part of the problem. There's people doing things, but he's probably not his kind of black guy. I'm just putting it out there like that. Hold on, this is 703. 703, tell us who you are, where you're calling from. Hello? 703-9?
Oh. I think the call dropped.
Okay, I think so. All right. Serge,
I was going to say, in terms of Cosmos with Dr. Tyson, I wrote about this 2 weeks ago on Shadow and Act. That show is being seen by at least 50 million people around the world. That, to me, is really significant because here is a show dealing with the most complex, most abstract concepts of space and physics, and it's hosted by a black man. And this is being seen around the world. I don't care if Charlamagne doesn't talk about the show. Charlamagne doesn't matter. What matters is that here's a black man who's being seen, a genius, who's being seen in over the world, in Asia, in South America, in Africa, in Europe, in North America. That's significant.
Well, and also,
we
have to give kudos to Seth MacFarlane because he's the one that's producing that show. So even then, you start to wonder, where the hell is – I hear what you're saying, Serge. I don't disagree with you. But I think Charlamagne matters in the sense that he has the attention of young folks of color and he should be the kind of person that could be able to disseminate this information. But a lot of what I see as far as black folks who are in a position of disseminating arts and science and media, they're stuck on the clown stuff. And like you said, this man is a man of color who represents, who is a pop cultural representation for science for everybody, and it's a black face. And yet, I don't see black folks. You know, we've reached out, Pillars. We'll probably have him on our show because his publishers have reached out to us. Of course, he's going to be on a show called Afro Nerd. It would be ridiculous for him not to be on here. But no one else wants to touch that because we're stuck on this tired meme. This meme is killing us, literally. So I think Charlemagne matters in some way because he promotes the stupidity.
Well, I want to chime in before we end real quick, and I wanted
to say
that.
We got about 4 minutes remaining. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to try to make this real fast. All right. Everything that we're talking about is extremely important and vital to our survival as creators of pop culture. The one thing we have to always keep in mind is that every time you go backwards from how something got created, like if something ends up on TV, you got to look at the process of how it ended up on television. There, at every studio in existence, particularly in Hollywood, in L.A., whatever you want to call it, there is a gatekeeper of some sort. The problem generally is some of the gatekeepers will not greenlight anything with a black face on it. And that's something that's discussed within the industry a lot, but it doesn't really leak out outside of it. There are people called current executives. They are the folks that put the stamp of either, yes, let's put this money toward development, because development process is extremely expensive, and that's really where a show is actually created, and the final version is what you see on television. Until we get more people of color, or just more people willing to take chances on people of color, particularly black science fiction and fantasy, we're not going to see that shift. And that's where the emphasis really has to be, in the so-called middle management of studio development processing, the middle management of studio development production. That's where we've got to see a real change demographically, or else we will not see what we want to see.
Let me
By the way,
to
before
call.
I go, yeah. is anybody going to be at C2E2 next month here in Chicago?
I don't think I'm going to be
there. No, I heard of it. I'm not going to be there.
Right. Okay.
Hold on
Never
one
mind.
Second. I have another caller. Hold on. Sorry, 703 again. 703? Hello? 703-99? I don't want to tell your whole number. All
no.
right, I tried. All right. All right, I don't get it. All right, we got about 2 minutes remaining. Gentlemen, a pleasure having you come through. I think this dialogue is imperative and important. And I think things will change, but I think we've got to get out of this mindset of, well, this can't be done because we're not so sure about the audience. I think, going like what Brandon said about going to Midtown Comics, and Darryl knows that too. We both go to that establishment. All types are there. I feel my fair share of women. Women weren't supposed to be in comic book stores either. Now they're
right
there. they're asking questions about of the captain and myself. A question I didn't think a woman would ask me about. Well, who's this Ultron person? Before Ultron was announced, I got that question from one of our female friends.
Well,
so,
at least they know more than Stan Lee, who doesn't know who Ultron is. Anyway, go.
What? Wait. Stan Lee doesn't know who Ultron is?
Let it go. Don't go there. Let it go.
Yeah,
okay,
just
right. Pay attention to this month's Playboy and the interview with Stan Lee. That's all I'll say.
Yes,
well, Stan's
just
91.
Read it.
He's 91. You might have forgot. He's allowed to forget. He's allowed to forget. And he created the Black Panther, so him and Jim Kirby. I mean, Jack
Jim Kirby? What?
Jack Kirby.
Anyway, you guys have been talking. It's been great. I've enjoyed myself. Brandon, good to hear from you. Hopefully I'll hear you guys again soon. This is Thaddeus.
Thank you, man, for coming through.
My pleasure.
Thank you. All right, we will do this again. We had an extended broadcast, folks. We'll be back on Wednesday for our Midweek and Review show. Brandon, as always, we'll speak behind the scenes, and we'll continue to push your product. Darryl, you stuck it out for 2 hours. We appreciate it. The captain was quiet. Captain, any thoughts? You didn't say much.
Great show, Sometimes you have to talk. Sometimes
Sometimes you talk, sometimes you listen, you know? So you have to balance it out.
Great show. And he's blackmail on each and every one of us with this show. The captain's going to lay into us during the week, I bet you.
All right, we're going to go out in an urban alternative groove. Rocket Juice and the Moon by Erykah Badu. We'll see you on Wednesday. It's been real. Thanks again, gentlemen.
Bye, y'all.
Take care.
On your journey to the sun.